Places of Britain by John Beddoe. The Anglo-Saxon Conquest, Part 2. The date of arrival of the Saxons, or Jutes, in England has been much debated. I trust I have shown some reasons for my belief that only piratical descents, not leading to permanent settlements, had taken place before the abandonment of Britain by the Romans. How soon after that event the Saxon colonisation began is a matter of less importance. Hay brings forward a good deal of evidence to show that it was in 428, but it may have been as late as 449, the commonly received date. In considering the manner and extent of the earlier conquests of the Saxons, as I shall continue to style them, in order to avoid any ambiguity that might arise from calling them English, one finds oneself compelled to make an estimate of the credibility of the only author who could have written from personal knowledge or direct information, namely Gildas. Gildas has been fiercely assailed of late years, chiefly by those writers who hold strong views as to the predominance of the British element in the modern English people. No doubt his work is liable to the strongest objections, meagre, in fact, copious in words, stuffed with sounding epithets. It is evidently the production of a monk who himself, more than half a barbarian, outdid through affectation the faults of civilized writers. Some portion of what he relates is, no doubt, incorrect and exaggerated, but there seems no reason to suspect him of willful falsification. Unfortunately, his aim was not so much to give us the historical facts of the conquest as to improve the whole affair for the benefit of his countrymen. The book must be taken for what it may be worth, which would not be very much indeed if we had anything better to substitute. It contains one famous passage, which, having been quoted by both Bede and Nennius, has greatly aided in bringing about the popular belief that in most parts of England the Britons were either exterminated or utterly enslaved. To the consideration of this I shall return after a while. Our other principal authorities for the Saxon conquest are Bede, Nennius, the Annales Cambriae, and Bruti Tuasogion, which, however, are extremely meagre on the points which concern us. The genuine poems of Aneurin and Cluach Hen, and above all, the Saxon Chronicle. To these may be added the works of numerous chroniclers who founded their works mainly upon the last mentioned storehouse of facts, including Ethelward, Henry of Huntingdon, and many others. In some cases, these later chroniclers seem to have had access to sources of information lost to us, but in other of their amplifications, it is pretty clear that they sacrificed truth to what they thought a literary effect. Putting together what we can gather from all these writers, we obtain a pretty fair account of the gradual conquest of Wessex, and some idea of that of Northumbria, and even of Sussex and Kent, but as to that of the rest of eastern Britain, we are left in the dark, in a most remarkable manner. The great gaps in the story might be partly filled up if we could, with Mr. Hay, trust in other authorities, which are generally regarded as spurious or valueless. I confess that the work of this laborious author has educed from what at first sight appears a mere chaos and farrago of invention, a certain number of not improbable conjectures. I would not be too ready to deny that there may have been a period of savage warfare preceding that of settlement, during which the whole east of Britain may have been ravaged, and in which the Frankish king Childeric may have played a considerable part. But on the whole, the ordinarily received view, shorn of certain features which are obviously conjectural and untrustworthy, such as the deeds of Port and Vidgar, seem more probable. Kent, then, appears to have been conquered not at a stroke, but gradually, after several battles in which the invaders were not uniformly successful. The conquest of Sussex was also gradual. The natives were, in one city at least, utterly extirpated, but they seemed to have retained their hold on the great forest of Andred for a further indefinite period. Meanwhile, settlements were being made all along the eastern coast, but no important states were constituted. Towards the end of the 5th century, Cerdic and Cynric began the reduction of Hampshire and Berkshire, which were the nucleus of the important kingdom of Wessex, and they even occupied some portions of Oxfordshire, while Surrey, so far as we can see, may have been still British. Meanwhile, Essex was being settled. From the evidence of mixed Saxon and Roman occupation, such as coins in some towns of Essex, it may be that this conquest was not so much a war of extermination as that of eastern Wessex seems to have been. Towards the middle of the 6th century, Ida begins in earnest the reduction of Northumbria, on the coast of which Anglian and Frisian settlements had been going on for some time. He overthrew the Britons in the great Battle of Cattreth, and appears to have displaced and compelled southwards some of the tribes that had opposed him. In the latter part of the same century, the monarchy of East Anglia is said to have been formed, but probably the north and the south folk had previously constituted independent tribes. The vigorous line of princes who ruled in Wessex meanwhile pushed their conquests northwards and westward, carrying their arms as far as Bedford, which was still Celtic in 571, and acquiring in 577 all the country up to Gloucester, including that town. How far beyond this, Ceolwulf extended his dominions is doubtful, but there is reason to think that he overran most of the valley of the Mid-Severn, which, however, must have been lost to him, but not necessarily lost to the Saxons, by the defeat of Wadnesburg in 591. Dr. Guest ingeniously showed the probability that the Damnonian kingdom, for some time after these events, still included the upper valley of the Bristol Avon and the western borders of Wiltshire. The history of Wessex is thenceforward that of a succession of contests against the Damnonian Welshmen and occasional extensions of the frontier by further conquests from them. In 658, the Welsh were driven across the Parret, which seems to have been the boundary for some time afterwards, though in Inni's time, 722, Taunton was already within the Saxon frontier. The conquest of Dorset is obscure. That of Devon was probably not effected till the time of Egbert, and cannot then have been altogether complete, though the statement that the Dean fought the Wheelas at Gafulford must be taken to imply the existence of a Saxon military colony, at the least, in Devon. The reported birth of Wilfrid at Crediton in the 7th century is worth noting. Possibly small local settlements of Saxons on the banks of the navigable rivers preceded the conquest. Certainly, my figures indicate that a blonde population is found precisely in those quarters. Still, there was a half-independent British community in Exeter till the time of Athelstan, who drove them out. i.e. probably put an end to the corporate or separate legal existence of the Welshmen, both then and elsewhere east of the Tamar. In Cornwall, they retained some shadow of independence yet a while. So much for the history of the south of England as it bears on our subject. That of the north is less clear, and that of the centre very scanty. Theodoric, son of Ida, is said by Nennius to have been besieged by Urien, Morgant, and other Welsh chieftains in Holy Island for 3 days. This may imply that the British frontier in Bernicia had not yet been thrust back so very far from the coast. Otherwise, the Anglian king could hardly have been so successfully surprised. Ethelfrid, Fleisauer, the Ravager, who acceded in 592, seems to have extended greatly the limits both of his kingdom and of Anglian colonisation. Rex fortissimus et gloriae cupidissimus, says Bede, in an important and often quoted passage. Qui plus omnibus anglorum primatibus gentem vestavit Britonum. Nemo enim in tribunibus, nemo in regibus, plures iorum terras, exterminatis vel subjectis, indigenis or tributarius gentii anglorum, aut habitabilis fecit. As only about 60 years intervened between the death of Ethelfrid and the birth of Bede, this evidence that from some districts the natives were entirely driven out seems to be very valuable. It is probable that Lancashire, Cumberland, and indeed all the country west of the mountains remained altogether Celtic for some time longer, though doubtless they paid tribute to Ethelfrid. The little British state of Elmet, about Leeds, endured till the time of Edwin, who expelled the king, and probably also the inhabitants, for their mere subjection would hardly have been noticed among the achievements of a king who, according to Bede, was suzerain of all the Britons, including the men of Gwynedd, Anglesey, and Man. In Edwin's reign, at least during the earlier part of it, the Mercian kingdom had not yet been constituted. This is indicated not only by the direct statement of the chroniclers, but by the whole history of the political relations between Edwin and Cuichelm of Wessex. I shall endeavour hereafter to augment by inferential evidence of other kinds the probability that a great part of Mercia was really colonised from Deira, or by way of the Humber and the Trent. Under Penda, Mercia seems to have reached as far as the Severn, though even this is uncertain. Under Wulfhere, a little later, Merwald, his brother, is spoken of as ruling in West Hyrcania, Herefordshire, but this can only indicate a sort of peninsular extension of Mercia. The growth of the Northumbrian states was checked for a time by the gallant efforts of the Welsh prince Cadwallon, who was probably the ruler of the northern Cumbrians as well as of North Wales, as the scene of some of his battles is placed at least as far north as Tynedale. After his defeat and death, Ozzy and Egfrid, for a time, must have held at least the suzerainty over the whole country, from the Mersey to the Forth, and from the Humber to the Mull of Galloway, and it would appear from the statements of Bede that under the latter monarch, some portions of the newly subjugated territory were actually colonised. Cartmel, Inverness, was British, but the gift of the land by Egfrid to the see of Lindisfarne, with all the Britons thereupon, implies a very complete subjection of the district to the Northumbrian power. So does the establishment of a bishop at Whittern in Galloway, and the apparent English name of that place. After Egfrid's defeat and death among the Picts, many of his conquests were lost, but Heribert the Anchorite, an Angle, dwelt near Carlisle, and there was a monastery on the Dacre River near Penrith, whereof the names of the abbot, Swedibert, and a presbyter, Tuidred, prove the Saxon character. That near Hexham, English was the language of the lower orders, is indicated by the story of the dumb man, cured by John, Bishop of Hexham. But in 731, the Northumbrian kingdom still extended its limits beyond those of the English language, for Bede, writing in that year, remarks of the Britons, Quippe qui quamvis ex parte sui sunt juris, nonnulla tamen ex parte Anglorum sunt servitio emancipati. Another flow of the tide of Northumbrian power took place about the middle of the 8th century, when King Edibert conquered Kyle and took Dumbarton. From that time until the Danish conquests, the independent British dominion was probably restricted to the most rugged and infertile parts of the ancient Cumbrian kingdom, and of these only the districts north of the Solway. But that the population of parts, at least of Cumberland, Westmoreland, Furness, remained British in language and feeling, is rendered more than probable by the reconstitution of a southern Cumbrian state in the latter half of the 9th century, when the English were too much occupied in resisting the incursions of the Danes to defend the outlying portions of their territory. In the Lothians and Tweedale, the Anglian population, once established, always remained predominant. The state and position of the Mercian and Welsh frontier must have fluctuated considerably from the time of its formation. We have seen that Ceolwin of Wessex may have been the first conqueror of the middle as well as of the lower portion of the Severn Valley. Cunadelin, Prince of Powys, is thought to have been the Condidan, slain by him at the Great Battle of Diorum, and in his elegy by Cluach Hen are allusions to the destruction by the enemy of Cunadelin's city on the Tren or Tern. So, at least, the poem is generally read. Moreover, near the same time, Gwen, the valiant son of Cluach, was slain at the ford of Morlas, close to the present frontier, though we are not distinctly told that his enemies were Saxon. It has been suggested by Dr. Guest that in the same campaign in which the Battle of Ferthanlege, Fadili maybe, in Cheshire, was fought, Ceolwin destroyed Wroxeter and overran the whole country as far as Cheshire, and I am disposed to embrace this view. But the portion of Wicca, which had been conquered in this and preceding campaigns, seems to have broken off the yoke of Wessex in the year 591 at the Battle of Wanborough. At this battle was won by a combined force of Britons and rebellious Saxons. We are left in doubt who retained the supremacy over Wicca, in which, however, was undoubtedly a Saxon land a century later. Its dialect is a southern one to this day, though it remained a sub-kingdom of Mercia after the 7th century. Though there were, as has already been mentioned, Saxon settlers, Magasetas, in the district between Severn and Wye, Mayhill between Ross and Gloucester, it was not until the reign of Offa that the Welsh were deprived of all Salop and of Herefordshire northeast of the Wye. Indeed, it is difficult to account for the paucity of hundreds, i.e. of free population, and the entire absence of history during the early part of the Saxon period in Staffordshire and East Cheshire, except by supposing that these districts were still little more than borderlands. In the early part of the 9th century, the process of pushing the march westwards was still going on. In 823, according to the Bruti Tui Sogion, the Saxons took the kingdom of Powys into their possession. But here, as in Northumbria, the further progress of the Saxon arms and frontier was checked by the Danish invasions, and for two centuries more, the Wye and Offa's Dyke may be said, roughly speaking, to have been the boundary of the nations, though Welshmen probably remained east of those boundaries in considerable numbers, obeying English law, just as they did in West Wessex when the laws of Ine were compiled. Ethnological changes in other parts of the British Isles and England and southern Scotland during the period we have been considering were probably but inconsiderable. Professor Rees holds that in Scotland, north of the Forth, vacillations occurred in the relative position and power of the Brittonic, Cymric, True Gaelic and Pictish elements, the last of which, he supposes, as we have seen, to have been still more or less Iberian or Ivernian in language in the early part of this period, basing his belief partly on the use of interpreters by the Gael Columba in his communications with some of the Pictish people. There can be a little doubt, however, that the Caledonians were a Gaelic people, and that they, who were classed as Picts by the Romans, continued to exist and flourish in the central highlands, where their type, as described by Tacitus, is still nowise uncommon, though intermixed with another, which was probably Iberian. In the west of Scotland, the true Scottic Irish streamed over at intervals into Argyll and the neighbouring isles, and the Irish Cretni or Picts similarly crossed over the narrow channel into Galloway, where they, reinforcing probably a pre-existing tribe of their own kindred, maintained a separate tribal existence for some hundreds of years, being still recognisable at the Battle of the Standard in 1138. In Ireland itself, meanwhile, no new element was added to the population, nor does it appear that continued intestine warfare brought about any considerable changes in those which already existed. Only the Cruithne, doubtless, were gradually melting away into the Gaelic-speaking mass. We may now proceed to consider the evidence to be derived from proper names of persons, from statements and allusions which occur in the documents of the period, and from the nature of laws and social usages as to the ethnological character of the subjects of the Heptarchy, the evidence of local names, and, the most important of all, that of a physical type and characteristics, must be reserved for a later stage. One is struck with the extreme rarity of names, apparently British, not only in the history, but in the documents of the whole period. Kemble has found a few in the earliest charters contained in his Codex Diplomaticus, but there is nothing discoverable that can be compared with what we find, for example, in Gaul under the Frankish kings, where persons with Latin names very frequently appear, not only as churchmen, but as counsellors and leaders. The name of Coifi, the heathen priest under King Edwin, who was first of the Northumbrians to embrace Christianity, may easily be derived from the Celtic, but hardly from the Teutonic. There is no corresponding fact in Wessex, but we meet there with one equally noteworthy in another rank, the name of Cadwalla, the savage conqueror of White and Sussex, being clearly Welsh, and its owner being claimed by the Welsh as a countryman and their king by the name of Cadwallader. There is, however, No sign in the histories of any revolution favourable to the Britons about that time, and Inne, his cousin, who succeeded, carried on wars of conquest against them, and allowed a smaller vergild for their slaughter than for that of Englishmen. No Celtic name appears in the genealogies assigned to Cadwalla, and it can hardly be doubted that, if a British at all, he was so by the mother's side only, which would probably be enough to account for his name, and for that of his brother Mull, the mule half-breed. There is, however, one portion of Mercia, and by no means the one in which the presence of un-Saxonized Celts might have been looked for from its geographical position, in which two very Celtic-looking names do occur. Ovin is noticed by Bede in the ancient history of Eli as Primus Ministorum of Etheldreda in AD 670, and is thought to have had the administration of the Isle of Eli. His monument is now in the cathedral there, and when Ethelfled's men in 916 stormed Derby, one of her captains of the race of the Lords of Eli, and called in the Welsh annals Gwenin, set fire to the town gate. If, in connection with these names, we consider that the Fen country long constituted separate districts called North and South Gerua, but very thinly peopled, having indeed only 600 hides in each, when we call to mind the story of St. Guthlac, who, about AD 700, was surrounded by night, in his cell near Croyland by a crowd of enemies, and from their rough and guttural speech imagined them to be Britons, by whom the country was then much harassed, though they turned out, to the saint's great relief, to be only devils and not Welshmen. And when we find in the history of Ramsay that that neighbourhood was, even in the time of Canute, liable to the infestation of British thieves, and that in the regulations of the Thegner Guild of Cambridge, probably in the reign of Ethelred, provision is made for the slaughter of a Welsh churl, and that at half price, we shall probably agree that a case is made out in favour of the Britons having remained as Britons in the neighbourhood of the Fens much longer than in most parts of England. I hope to show, further on, some little evidence of a physical character in support of this view. The use of the words Vwil, a Welshman, Vwilish, Welsh, etc., is not infrequent in the ancient Saxon laws. These words do not, however, occur in the ordinances of the Kentish kings, though the frequent mention of Esnes and Thiawis shows that the servile class was numerous. One would infer that the Welsh language, and with it the distinction of race, had become extinct by the time of King Ethelbert, which is inconsistent with the notion of any considerable portion of the native population having been suffered to remain in Kent by the conquerors. If Mr. Kemble be correct in his reckoning of the Kentish Wergilds, the Kentish churl was valued at half the worth of an earl, whereas in Wessex the ratio of values was as 1 to 3 at least, or 6 in the case of the full thane, in Mercia as 1 to 6, and in Northumbria 1 to 7.5. These differences may be connected with the relatively higher value of the simple freeman among the Frisians and Franks than among the Saxons and the Angles, whose original constitution appears to have been more aristocratic. But, at all events, the relatively high wergild of the Kentish churl makes it very improbable that he was, as a rule, of British descent. We have some valuable material in the oft-quoted Laws of Inne of Wessex, who lived at a period when the prevalence of Christianity had in some small degree mitigated the horrors of wars of conquest, and who had himself reduced West Somerset to be part and parcel of Wessex. Under Ine, a Welshman might be free, might own or rent land, and might be holding five hides, attain the rank, or rather value, of a 600-man. We hear of no other 600-man, as Robertson remarks, and it may be that he was in a class by himself, below all thanes of true Saxon blood, who were 1,200 men. A distinction was still drawn, too, between the English and the Welsh churl. The life of the former was valued at 200 shillings, but that of the latter, though he held a hide of land, was but 120 shillings, and if he had none, he was rated at 60 shillings, the price of a thiol, or slave. We may infer that in a considerable portion of the Wessex of that period, about AD 700, Welshmen and Englishmen lived intermixed under English law, and though the former, as the conquered race, were subjected to some derogatory legal provisions, they were not altogether deprived of their lands, and remained too numerous and powerful to be treated without some consideration. It by no means follows, however, that this intermixture extended to the eastern portion of Wessex, which had been conquered before the introduction of Christianity, when community of religion had not begun to soften national antipathies. In Mercia, the Earl was worth six times as much as the churl. The probability of the latter, being generally of British origin, is somewhat greater, therefore, than in eastern Wessex. From Northumberland, we have precise information in the fragment entitled The North People's Law, which, however, Kemble, without reason, assigned, seems to consider a suspicious authority. It sets the value of a churl's life at 200 shillings, while that of the lowest rank of thane is not less than 1,500. This comparative elevation of the upper ranks may have taken place subsequently to the Danish conquest, for it is not probable, from the nature of that conquest, that any considerable number of churls were Danish. The Sokman does not appear at all under that name. He may have been a development of the Danish Lysing, or of the churl. Welshmen are provided for almost as in Wessex, a landholder of that race being worth 120 shillings, and a simple Welsh freeman, 70 shillings. A churl may rise to be a thane, but it is not stated that a Welshman may do so. These provisions for Welshmen are to be accounted for by the continued existence of the British language, as well as the British race, under Danish and Norse, as well as Anglian, Northumbrians, in Cumbria and Craven. This latter district, from which we have evidence of a singularly interesting kind, derived from the contents of caves that civilised Britons took refuge there from Anglian or other invaders, is generally supposed to be the Comot of Carnarvon, spoken of in one of the triads as having remained British in speech. The name Carnarvon or Cornaby, said to be applied by the peasantry of Warwickshire to a district in the centre of that county, raises a suspicion whether the Comot of Carnarvon may not have been in the forest of Arden rather than in the wilderness of Craven. One is tempted to refer the name to the tribe whom the Romans called Cornavi and who are located in the east and northeast of the Severn. The population of both these districts retains decided marks of pre-Anglian descent. There is a passage in the law of the Northumbrian priests, a code also of date subsequent to the Danish conquest, which has been held to imply the continued presence of Welshmen, acknowledged as such throughout the whole country, a thing on other grounds very improbable. If a king's thane, it is said, make denial, let 12 be named to him, and let him take 12 of his kinsmen, and 12 wallowants, and if it fail, etc., etc. If a land-owning man make denial, then let be named to him of his equals, as many wents as to a king's thane, etc. If a churlish man make denial, then let be named to him of his equals, as many wents as to the others, etc. Thorpe supposes these wallowents to have been Britons of Cumbria, but it seems obvious that an inhabitant of the centre of Deira, and York is mentioned in the law, could not have been expected to import 12 Britons from Cumbria beyond the mountains to be his jury or compugators. Bosworth says, wallowents peregrini, Britanni, iter, dicti, a Saxonibus. But as this is the only passage in which the word occurs, it seems to me easier to suppose that it means simply strangers, strangers in blood, as distinguished from kinsmen, and has no reference to race or nation, than to believe that there were in the Danish period, in the neighbourhood of York, such numbers of landholding Welsh-speaking men that a dozen of them could be readily got together for every legal proceeding. There is no other reference in the code to the existence of Welshmen.